Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and I'm here with my co-host, Tim Henney. Today in the program, it's a conversation with local author Terry Sidford, who's written a book called 100 Hearts. It's 100 surveys completed by 100 women.
Morning, Lynn. Then we speak with Matt Linden. He's a hydrological engineer with Laughlin Water, an adjunct professor and civil engineer at the University of Utah, and he's a writer. He joins us now to talk about, guess what? Water.
That's all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a not-for-profit community hospital and a proud supporter of KPCW. At Park City Medical Center, our OBGYNs use the latest surgical advances, like minimally invasive hysterectomies, endometrial ablation, and laparoscopic procedures. Even better, they also offer the convenience of having your procedure close to home. Doctors Jeannie Falk, Lorraine Sabella, and Jeremy Clark are the only OBGYNs who practice surgery and deliver right here in Park City. Make an appointment today by calling 435-658-7400.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, what do you do in the face of adversity? How do you define courage? What was your defining moment that made you who you are today? These are some of the questions that were posed in a survey of 100 women that our guest Terry Sidford put together. She joins us now to discuss, well, this survey that she's woven into a wonderful little book called 100 Hearts, 100 Surveys Completed by 100 Women, stories that honor and celebrate all of them. Terry Sidford, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what was your whole idea behind this? Just that, like anyone, we've heard lots of great stories and you wanted to bring those stories out even more?
I did. I was really inspired to write this book when I witnessed firsthand a very close friend of mine who tragically lost her son. And I noticed that she handled it with grace and love and strength like I'd never seen before. Not in the way that she did. And I also realized that many women, many of whom I've had the honor of coaching as a life coach, demonstrate courage in their lives daily. And they fight for who they really are, to live an authentic life, opposed to the life that's been imposed, imposed on them as far as stigmas and living a certain way as a woman. And that takes courage. And most of the women that I found in the survey felt the same way. But I decided to create a survey from 100 women to find out what makes a difference of someone that just crumbles under adversity versus someone has resilience and does not lose who they are in the face of adversity.
And did you choose women because these types of things, courage and adversity, are so diverse with women as compared to men? Did you just have a lot of women in your life?
I just had a lot of women in my life, and I witnessed it from my life coaching. I was able to see people, or women particularly, because most of my clients are women, demonstrate courage in a way that they didn't even see that they were demonstrating courage. So they didn't really understand that they were living a courageous life. Most women don't. They just get up and they do it.
Hmm.
And they find solutions.
Do you know why most of your clients are women? Are you specifically targeting women, or are you open to anyone?
I'm open to anyone. I just have women attracted to my style. I create a very safe environment for them. And what I learned in the answers from these 100 surveys is that women need a safe place to really tell their stories. They don't really feel safe to do that. And for some reason, I have that personality that people are, women are attracted to. And I would love to do another book on courage with men, because I think men would love to be able to tell their stories as well, but aren't as safe to do that. And maybe a woman is more challenging for them at times to do that with. So that's just what I found.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've done interviews with people about the masculine and the feminine, and I would say we're sort of 3 or 4 to 1, sort of the women theme and story versus the male theme and story. But there certainly are stories on both sides of that spectrum. But I wanted to ask you about courage and how you define it. And I'm sure your stories are part of defining courage, and maybe it defines itself through the stories. But is there a simple way that you would define courage? Because it seems like there are a lot of, you know, depending on who you speak to, there are a lot of definitions of what courage actually is.
Absolutely. I think there's been a lot of misunderstandings about courage, misconceptions about courage. And I think courage is something that is very individual, is what I found on with the answers to these surveys. It could be just getting up in the morning. Courage could be very quiet, could be something that's very personal inside that they're dealing with. Other times it can be something very outrageous that they need to muster up the courage to just get through another minute in their life. But what I found in my own definition of courage is not changing who you are and standing up for who you are under any circumstance that life throws at you, and be resilient to that. You can let these stories define you that happen in your life, or you can let these stories help find your strength and redirect you back to your heart and never lose who you are. So there's a huge difference.
I'm wondering if your definition of courage changed by writing the book and hearing the stories. Would you have had a different definition before this book?
A little bit. I think that's one that I had for myself in my own life. But the stories or the answers from these women really defined it for me, and it was a very much deeper definition. And I also realized that it's not just one size fits all, that it's various definitions of courage depending on the person. So yes, it did change it for me.
Take us back to your friend who lost her son and the courage that she exhibited that you found, well, that prompted you to write this book. Tell us a little bit about that and the type of courage and what you learned about courage with her.
Wow. I'll try to do this without getting emotional, because whenever I think about her, it's extremely emotional for me. Mm-hmm. I have two sons. Her son was 18 years old and was a perfect child. And in his phone, under his mother's name, he had my hero. She came one day, and she came over to our house. She was our housekeeper. And she would come into our house with love in her heart and a smile on her face. And she would leave our house clean, but also just an essence of a loving, kind person was there. She was amazing. She came one day with flyers, her missing son. Mm-hmm. And she told us that he just disappeared. And I watched her, and she was quiet, but she didn't change who she was through this whole process. A whole year went by, no word, no sign of anything about her son. And I watched her still be who she was as far as this loving, kind, graceful person. And I had my own son. I didn't know how she was getting through the day. So, they found her son in Wyoming, and he had been killed. And she still maintained her strength and her integrity and her love in her heart. And, you know, that's courage.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't change who she was, and she had every reason to. So it really inspired me to find out. I thought 100 surveys would be a good example of you know, what makes a difference of someone that really takes a difficult time and is still resilient and doesn't change who they are versus
right.
other people that go the other way.
Yeah,
and I feel like I found that.
Well, it's funny when you speak of courage, I'm sure all of our listeners right now are thinking about their own way that they express courage. And I realize that I've got a little inner conflict going with it. Sometimes I feel if I express a lot of courage that I'm really repressing other things like being vulnerable and being exposed and admitting to myself or anyone else that I'm fearful. But on the other hand, it's very empowering it can be empowering to do that and to just, it allows you just to step into it. So it is a really big topic. And how are some of the other ways that you have helped people? Well, how do you help people find it?
That's a great question. But one thing I wanted to answer was what you just were talking about when you feel fearful is I help people connect to their heart and who they are. And they find that place that they can always go back to because that's where your strength is when you're connecting to that under all circumstances. And the answers to the survey, a lot of the women said, courage is not getting rid of fear, but it's facing fear and moving through it anyway. So I think that's a misconception. So I help my clients to say, you know, it's okay. Fear, you face it and then move through it. It's not something that is that you don't have to have in your life. It's not a wrong thing to be feeling that or totally petrified in that moment. But keep going. It's perseverance, which makes the difference. And just really connecting to your heart. And the definition in the dictionary of courage is heart.
Mm.
So it's a French definition.
Right. Cool. Yeah. I love that saying, do one thing you fear every single day. And it's a really great practice. And you can see how it energizes you. You saw Tim come across here and try to, I'm trying to teach him how to run this board here. He's
after
very fearful.
How many years?
After nearly, I don't know, 4 years
I'm
or so.
I'm still traumatized.
Right, right. But it energized you, didn't it? Like you do a little thing that you think you can't do and that you fear, and somehow it energizes you, even if you fail partially. Not that you failed, Tim.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. And really, if you're not experiencing fear, you're not pushing yourself past your comfort zone. And that's where you grow and change. So it's actually, you know, a new perspective. Fear is good.
It's that embracing fear.
Right.
Now, are the stories that the women tell, how did you select the women and their stories? I mean, those are one and the same to some degree. Are they local? Are they, you know, from across the country? Where did you come up with these people?
I started out with friends and family and clients. And I had a hard time getting back the surveys, so I expanded it and asked them to send it to women who might be interested in filling out the survey. And interesting enough, there was a lot of women who didn't want to fill it out because they didn't think they were courageous. And after they filled it out and I read, you know, their answers, they were courageous in all areas of their life. So that was an interesting thing in gathering the surveys. So it ended up, I ended up receiving surveys from all over the country and out of the country, and all walks of life, age 17 to 80.
You know, I'm not sure how to ask this question, but it came up in a discussion that I had with my son, and we were talking about a recent interview that we did with Liz Gilbert, and my son is much deeper than I am, and so don't take offense at this, but just even the way you said that, you know, you started with your family and then you broadened out from there and all walks of life. Well, all walks of life within a fairly narrow band of people who have the time, the energy, the wonderful life to have the time to spend contemplating courage and bliss and joy in their life. That's a very select demographic, right? I mean, if you look at the world, there are so many people who would never even have the ability to contemplate those things because they're in survival mode. And what about courage with those people? Did this courage get you thinking about the broader courage that it takes? I'm sure it did, but where did that go?
Absolutely. I mean, I want this book to help. That's the whole reason one of the other reasons I did this is I really want this to be a community for women around the world to know that they are courageous. Just if we plant a seed that, you know, getting up and trying to figure out where food is, right, in other parts of the country, that's courageous to feed their family. But just know that they are being courageous, and what is that? And that's a story that I do want to get around and feel that they're not alone in this journey.
Yeah. I want to just read a little bit from the book, or rather paraphrase. And it would be very impossible to not be inspired by this book about courage and resiliency. And this one is a question, have you had the opportunity to demonstrate courage? And it's just so great, the variety of responses. Every day I demonstrate courage, I start my own business. I joined Toastmasters. I learned to race a vintage Porsche race car. I played the role of Eva Peron, and I played in front of live audiences. I worked for Goldman Sachs, and that took courage. I left my husband for another man, which is the most courageous thing I've ever done. Here's a really interesting one. When a large group of men were telling very degrading jokes about women, I stood up in front of the group of 110 men and told them it was neither funny nor okay. They booed.
That's one of my favorites.
Oh, that is just great. You know, a new career, having a baby at only 23 weeks and helping it survive, losing close loved ones, and it just goes on and on. Breast cancer treatment and going through leadership schools. There are, and of course, there are 100 responses to each of these questions. What a great thing you've done here.
Thank you. I mean, these stories and these answers will, many of them you'll connect with. Some of them will make you cry. But I believe that they will all inspire and uplift you, and they will lead you to your own courage.
Yeah. So, You've had a couple of book signings and a couple of places you've been around town so far. You're going to be at Dolly's, I think it's in the 1st of December.
December 12th from 2 to 4.
Okay. And so how is the distribution of this book? Is it beyond Park City and Summit County? Where has it ended up?
Yes, it's all over. And you can go to 100 Hearts, spelled out, 100hearts.com to purchase it. Amazon, Barnes & Noble. So we have them available. So you can go to any of those sources to get the book.
And I would assume Dolly's.
Oh, and Dolly's, of course.
Now, you don't just talk about courage. You talk about resiliency. But then also, and this is an interesting question, because with the city council candidates during this election season, as Leslie Thatcher has been interviewing them, one of the questions she asks is, you know, who is a mentor for you? Who are role models in your life? And that's one of the things you ask in the book as well. And it's been really interesting, just hearing her ask that question has made me reflect on how would I answer that question? And it's an interesting observation that some of us know exactly who our role models are, and some of us don't.
Absolutely. A lot of the answers were, there were many people in my life. But I also, just reading it, a lot of grandparents, which were interesting. Mm-hmm. And teachers. And I think it's just, if we read that, then you realize that we all can make a difference in people's lives, and you really don't realize that one thing you might say or do with someone could affect them the rest of their life or change their whole world. I thought that was a great question. You know, who inspired them to be who they are?
And you're not really sharing the stories of the 100 surveys to a specific narrow audience, as Lynn just pointed out. By sharing these stories, it gets the people whoever reads it starts to think about how they would answer those questions themselves. So it is actually relevant to a much broader audience, instead of an audience who you might say, oh gosh, you know, they could be my client in life coaching, and here are the things that we would focus on. It's everybody can read this and go, now, how would I deal with that?
Absolutely. I mean, this is for men and women and all walks of life. And one of the questions that some of the women said that they never thought of was, you know, if you were to leave a legacy, what legacy do you want to leave? And they said, wow, I never thought of that. Now, would that change how you live your life? Are you living your life so that you do leave the legacy that you want to live? So that was kind of a surprising answer. They said, wow, I never thought about that. So they're thought-provoking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really pleased with the answers. And I know that you'll be inspired, or you'll, something inside of you will be inspired, whether it's, you know, wow, I want to leave a legacy. I want to mentor somebody. I want to be more courageous to do something in my life. So there's many different questions, I think, that will change people's lives.
Did you have, I assume you must, you said it when Lynn was reading through that, you said, oh, that was one of my favorites. So I get the sense that you have some favorite answers. Did you have a favorite question that you asked that maybe you were most surprised by?
Yes. I was surprised that that was the question. I wouldn't have told you this when I first started it, but if you were to change anything in your life, what would you change? Would you change anything? And majority of the women said, no.
Yeah.
And that was because they said, because that really made me who I am today. All those experiences made me who I am today. So what I want listeners to know about that is that you need these stories, these things that have happened to you in your life, be proud of them. And don't hide them, share them. And stand up for who you are. It makes you who you are. And it makes you have more character and compassion and depth. So that's really something I want everyone to know. They don't have to hide about these stories that have happened to them, whether it's their parents that were kind of messed up, you know? Did they have a choice in that? You know, don't feel bad about that and feel proud.
And also really being convinced that everything in your past put you where you are today is a really good way to let go of grudges and, you know, harboring resentment and
yes.
all that.
Yes. And have the courage, you know, to say, you know, I can still be who I am, who I meant to be, my best self in life, regardless of what's happened to me. And I know a lot of people will say, hey, yeah, that's not possible. But I believe it is possible. I really do. You know, maybe you need a lot more work to do on that if something tragic happened in your life, and that's okay. But I do believe that people have the courage within themselves to really fight past that.
Yeah. All right. Well, Terry Sidford, thank you so much for joining us today. And I know you do a lot of things in your everyday life, but one of those is you're a life coach, as you mentioned. Just talk briefly about that practice.
I've been life coaching people for 16 years, and it's really different than counseling or therapy. It's really about what's happening in your life now, where you want your life to go, and really helping people connect to the true essence of who they are, regardless of stigmas and what other people have imposed upon them, and take that and start living the life they really want to live. And it's really the most honoring thing I could ever do in a person's life is for them to find out what they're passionate about and what their purpose is. So you can go to createyourlifecoaching.net, find out more about what I do. I also do speaking. And also, if you want to purchase the book, it's at 100hearts.com. Or if you want to find out more about the book. And I do offer a free consultation if you want to know what life coaching is really about.
Does somebody have to do a fair amount of personal work and that therapy that you just referred to get to a point in life where they're ready for life coaching, to be present and looking to the future?
If they have issues that keep them in the past and they can't get past that, then that's where counseling and therapy would come in. We have to go into the past, but we don't want to stay there too long.
Yeah.
It's more about learn from the past so we can be in the present and move on. And so if they're stuck in the past, then they need to go do that work. And during that process, I'm very honest about that. Like, you know, if there's a point where I'm not trained to do this for you, then I'm going to let you know that.
Hmm. That's great. Well, Terry, best of luck with your book, 100 Hearts. It's 100 surveys completed by 100 women. They're stories that honor and celebrate all of them. Thanks for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment to talk. Well, we'll move from hearts into water. Why not? It seems a logical segue, right?
Water for hearts? Wasn't there a book?
That was like water for chocolate.
Oh, that chocolate thing.
Maybe we'll, by the end of the hour, we will have talked about chocolate as well. Why not? We'll be right back after this.
Hi, this is Carolyn with Alpine Apothecary. Mountain Life hosts Lynn and Tim and their guests help to keep us feeling and looking good. With skincare products made in our lab, using ingredients provided by Mother Nature, we help keep skin feeling and looking good. Alpine Apothecary, specialty pharmacy, taking care of the skin you're in.
Hi, I'm Stacy at Miller Orthodontics, sponsor of the Minor Nation Report on KPCW. Did you know most dental injuries occur during organized sports? Although face masks on helmets help, custom-made mouth guards have been shown to greatly reduce the risk of dental injury. Learn more about Miller Orthodontics at m2ortho.com. We also support minor youth and high school football. Go Miners!
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. We were just speaking with Terry Sidford, her book 100 Hearts. That was really nice. Well, moving on here to water. Water may be the defining element of our time. In fact, it probably is. Water supply, water quality, water that falls from the sky in the form of snow to support our economy, water demand. Local resident Matt Linden is a hydrological engineer who lives and breathes water. Not literally. I mean, he's joining us now in the studio to talk about anything from heavy metals in water to water economy to the tipping points and the point of no return, wherever that may be with water. The Mountain Life is a program about health and nutrition, and of course, water is inextricably linked to those two items. Matt Linden, thanks for joining us. Welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
Well, we've been thinking we'd have you on the show for some time now.
Right.
And we usually let you go to some of those other programs like This Green Earth or somewhere else. But, you know, it is really tied to health and nutrition and our lives here in the mountains. And, you know, I just want to say this. My family lives in Montana, and whenever I go up there, I see all of the water everywhere. And I have to say, it really scares me. It makes me feel like we don't have water here, and that water's going away.
That is great. You do go to Montana, and you see the big rivers, and you see wetter climates where water's flowing, and it's visibly flowing. It's very interesting that way because it's visible. But I think we still do have a lot of water around here. Let's face it, we get, you know, 2 to 4 feet worth of precipitation in the mountains every year. Now, how we use that water, how that's allocated, is another case. And I think we do have a lot of water. But for the most part, we spend our water growing grass, whether it's grass for cows, alfalfa, hay, or whatever, grass for golf courses, grass for parks. Grass for our front lawns. You know, I think 80% of our water goes to those kinds of usage. And so instead of focusing on maybe our demand or our supply of it, which is pretty fixed, maybe even getting smaller, let's look at the demand for it and how we use our water and how maybe we waste it.
Yeah. Let's talk about supply for a little bit. I'm wondering about the supply that changes when we don't have the reservoir of water that is in the form of snow. In other words, when our water comes now more and more in the form of rain and less in the form of snow, how has that impacted and how will it impact our supply when it just runs down the hills and into the rivers in a way?
Yeah, that's a great question. And anybody who's been here for a while, I mean, we used to remember ski season was from October to Memorial Day. Now we're lucky if it's Christmas to Easter. Mm-hmm. And so our season has been truncated, and we get rain now during every month of the year. For the past 3 or 4 years, that's been the case. And that's been the prediction. As the climate changes, we get more rain, we get less snow, we have less storage in the snowpack, which is, you know, has been our go-to for so many years. And so now the runoff is coming off a little bit differently. It's coming off slower. It's coming off earlier. Maybe more of it's going into groundwater. Maybe more of it's evapotranspirating. We're not getting enough of it, as much of it. So the, you know, the management of the water resources has changed. And so some people are saying, oh, so what does that mean? Does that mean we build more dams, you know, try to catch that rain, to catch that runoff when it just happens to come? Or, you know, do we, you know, go towards more groundwater usage, which we have been, and rely less on some of the surface water that we have in the past for agricultural purposes? And so we are adapting, we are evolving as this is taking place. And it's a word I've heard several times this morning on the radio, a word that Bruce Erickson loves to use. We've kind of gone from environmentalism to sustainability to resilience. And resilience applies, you know, some sort of adaptability. And, we do what we can with the climate that we're given. And, we're all part of that right now.
So, Matt, this concept of adaptation of the system and what we do locally makes me think, from your perspective, you have to look at global systems, a regional system, and a local system, and they're all interrelated and linked. And I know you have the ability to kind of look and think about that whole system, the whole earth-water system. But from the standpoint of our community, what would you recommend we as a community focus on? Should we be thinking globally and acting locally, or should we be myopically focused on our Park City or maybe Snyderville Basin or maybe Summit County or maybe Wasatch backwater system? Where are our resources, you know, mental and financial, best used in sort of all those systems and how they relate to each other?
Well, that's a great question, and we do tend to focus locally when we can, and our water developers around here have done that for years and have done the best they can working with the water that's available in our basin, and, you know, dealing with water quality issues and using the water that's clean and the water that's good.
And is your assessment of that effort a fairly positive one, or do you?
Oh, I would say it's a very positive one. We've, you know, and the thing is up here, you know, we have, if you have money, you have water. And we've thrown a lot of money developing our water systems and getting water for the future.
Lot more will be spent in the next 10 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, the regionalizations of things and the concurrency. The next step that we have been taking over the past several years is bringing water in from other basins, bringing water in from say, the Weber River, about a billion gallons at this point per year. So, when water starts getting tough, you start going out to other basins, and that's when it becomes more of a regional thing. And you start looking at, you know, how is water shared with everybody here along the Wasatch Front, and how do we get a piece of that pie? And then you take a look at it, you know, maybe more globally. You know, we look at our reservoirs here, and they fill, and they empty, and they fill, and that's kind of indicative of our local climates, what's happened over the past couple, 2 or 3 years, or 5 years. But you look at maybe a region-wise, you look at Lake Powell, you look at Lake Mead. The Colorado River. And that's showing what's going on in the region, per se, you know, as far as supply and demand.
Well, and there's that concept of, you know, you just said it, money flows to water. We have a lot of money. We've been throwing money at our water. We're importing from other basins. That means somebody else isn't getting that money or that water. And maybe it's because they haven't put the money into it. And that raises a question of, you know, just fairness. And if we have a resource, there are ways to treat it. Either you can buy it and those with the most money control it, or you can figure out ways to conserve and to share this scarce, precious resource so that everybody has enough. Where do you stand on that?
Well, and that is the question. Is this a commodity? Is water a commodity to go to the highest bidder, or is it a public welfare entitlement? We all deserve our fair share of the water. And so far it's worked as a public welfare entity or entitlement, but it's kind of making that shift towards a commodity to be bought and sold by the highest bidder, and that gets a little bit dangerous. So the water that we're getting that somebody else isn't using is usually agricultural water that's being turned into municipal water, and that's going on all around the West, and that they're hoping that transition is enough to keep us going for a very, very long time. But you take a look at the whole world view of water and climate and the climate change. And, you know, we do pretty well because we have money and water becomes inconvenient for us sometimes. Oh, okay, maybe we can't ski on it or we can't green up our lawns. But as climate progresses, it's going to be the poor people in the world that are going to suffer. And I think they're already suffering. And I think some of the big battles in the future will be over water and food. And I think it's already happened with some of the droughts that have been happening across the world and the wars that have started because of that.
Mm-hmm. Wanted to ask you a little bit, going back to what Tim was talking about. We bring in, I think it's about 12 miles of pipeline, isn't it? Or is it 8 from Rockport? Reservoir.
I'm not sure of the length of it, but it's, you know, a good 1,000 vertical feet.
Right, right. So we bring it up and over, and there's a lot of energy that is used to do so. And yet it's a source that we we have to have because we have to have what they call redundancy in our water supply, where we're not pulling all of our water out of abandoned mine tunnels. And it's scary to me, 8 miles, 12 miles, whatever it is. That's kind of scary. But if you go, and I want to ask about regional water lines, and you know, you hear about the Colorado River that used to flow all the way into Mexico that doesn't even begin to make it that far because the Los Angeles, you know, basin or whatever has right. pulled off that water.
Right.
Talk about some of those big water lines. And in addition, the one that was proposed to head into Washington County here in Utah.
Right. And as we start looking farther afield for water, our water projects just keep getting bigger and bigger. You know, they expand exponentially with our demand. And it's put a big demand on the Colorado River. And so I think as for an effort to get a piece of our pie, our Utah piece of pie of the Colorado River, the big proponent is for that Lake Powell pipeline. And that's 120 miles of huge pipe to bring water to Washington County, to St. George area, and take... you know, take a big chunk out of Lake Powell in the Colorado River. And that's, you know, that seems to be the solution. It's always let's
build a pipeline.
Let's increase the supply. Let's not think about demand. And St. George, Washington County has some of the highest per capita usage in the state, at least, and in the country. And there's not a big effort down there to, you know, push the conservation end of things. And partly because, you know, we focus more on supply and getting our piece of the pie of that before California comes in and takes the rest of it. You know, they have 55 congressmen, we have 4. So if push comes to shove, how do you think that might go?
Yeah.
So besides the congressmen and the battle of trying to capture and control before somebody else comes and takes it, there's also the ability to use pricing to manage water and to influence behavior. And what you're talking about is the current paradigm is we mine water. We're extracting more water from whatever source there is, whether we're importing it from rivers or reservoirs or we're drilling deeper wells or we're pulling it out of tunnels versus mining efficiencies, which ties into conservation. Do you see that shifting in places like Washington County and St. George? I think when we talked to Zach Frankel, he said they pay the lowest rates for water in St. George out of all of Utah, and they have the highest per capita consumption. That mm-hmm. seems like a pretty direct connection. We have much higher water rates in Park City, and we are seeing significant gains in conservation and efficiency.
Absolutely, and I think that's, you know, probably our first defense against this. In Utah, we subsidize water in a lot of ways. They're looking for the whole state to pay for the Lake Powell pipeline. Not if it was just Washington County, their water bills would go through the roof, and they wouldn't really be able to sell it to them. So they try to spread the load out. They try to bury it in property taxes, and the state does a lot of subsidized water projects. Low interest, no interest, 30-year, 50-year loans, so that the price of water stays artificially low, unfortunately. And that was kind of set up to help the agricultural community, but it's been maintained, and it's done us a disservice where we're paying very little for water, and so people aren't that interested in conserving it. In the past 10 years around here, we've started paying the price and the worth of water, and it is amazing. Even though the people around here are fairly well off, they pay attention. And when water bills start getting expensive, they start adjusting their usage. And a lot can be done with water pricing, just to give people a heads up of what water is worth.
Well, I have to say that I'm paying a lot of attention to water
you
these
are,
days.
You are. You're a smart guy, yes.
And for a variety of reasons. But let me focus on one other than being on city council, which is directly tied to the amount of money that we're going to be spending on water infrastructure and things of that nature. I live in a condo with a homeowners association, and all during this summer, during 3- and 4-day rainstorm events, our sprinkler system ran mm-hmm. every other day.
Right.
And I found that to be just absolutely incredible. The waste and inefficiency involved in that was mind-blowing to me. I brought it to the attention of my HOA numerous times. And you know what? Basically, the response is, you know, it's just too time intensive, takes too much person resource. We don't have the people, the money allocated to go turn it off, turn it on. So they switch it on in the spring, blow it out in the fall, and it's on an every other day cycle, regardless of what's going on. And I think that's an example of the pricing has not reached the tipping point to encourage my HOA and, of course, the owners who are on the board of the HOA to right. take action yet. So that tells me more work needs to be done on pricing to get their attention.
Yeah, it seems as if it's personal responsibility for it, people pay attention. When there's industrial responsibility for it, maybe not so much so. There's a lot of second homes around here that do the same thing. Set the sprinklers to go off every other day. They let them go. They write the check. They don't really seem to care. But, you know, the people who live here and the people who pay attention and pay these bills have really started.
They have. And they should be rewarded for that.
Absolutely. If you want to waste water, then maybe you're going to pay more than your share for the water system. And if you're going to conserve, maybe you get cut a break. And that's how the pricing system has been set up in the city and in the county.
Talk about the tipping point. Like, when is it going to be come to the point where consumption no longer is a badge of honor, as it seems to be? You know, it does. Like, I have the money, and therefore I have the right to consume.
Therefore, I think those changes can be generational, almost, where this new generation is coming up. And I'm hoping this is a new generation of sustainability, where maybe they don't want to have a house that's bigger than their parents. Or maybe they don't want to drive a Hummer to show who they are or what they are. That their badge of courage will be to have a brown lawn in August. Brown is the new green. And I'm hoping, you know, and all this comes about with education, and price points can be very educational, and they can set up tipping points for changing people's view. And there's talk of this blue revolution, where everybody starts looking at, okay, what is our demand for water, and does it really have to be as silly as it is?
Mm. You asked a question before, Tim, about local versus regional, and I wonder about that. I hear a lot of people who go to great lengths locally in their own residence to conserve water, and then they see the fields that are swampy sometimes. They see the golf courses. They see us putting in more and more development. And you can probably both answer this, because I know there's some legal structure that makes us have to put in the water infrastructure and find the water before the development even happens.
Absolutely. But
I, you know, it always comes back to that question, why should we conserve at our house? My lawn's already brown. Why should I conserve when no one else is?
Well, and that's always a great question, is, you know, is one person going to make a difference? And in the big picture, maybe not. But, you know, if you put enough of one persons together, then you make a difference. And that's where education comes in, where we start changing what the status quo is, where we change how everybody thinks about it and everybody's uses. And we get mass changing on our patterns.
Yeah, and I say to whoever brings that argument to me, in my neighborhood, one by one by one have taken out their Kentucky bluegrass and replaced them with rocks and bark and, you know, and that is a one by one thing. And pretty soon everyone's doing it.
It's contagious.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, and that's the old thing. If, you know, if the people will lead, the leaders will follow. If we start using less and less, then they have to adjust how they deal with their supply. If they're not selling as much water, they have to adjust rates. Unfortunately, rates can go up when there's conservation. So there's almost a disincentive to conserve. But people, I think, in their heart of hearts, make the decision that, yes, this is a valuable resource. This is a resource that's as valuable as air, and we need to take care of these resources.
So, Matt, Lynn just touched on this, and she said she wanted to hear from both of us, but I'm going to defer to you.
No,
water as a concurrency issue with development. What role does water play in development, and why do people have the view that if we don't provide water, we can stop the growth?
Well, I think that kind of thing, stopping growth with water or with traffic or with those kinds of things, I think maybe takes the heat off of making the harder decisions of just saying no. But we've had for the past 20 years, at least in the county, a fairly good concurrency system where it says if you don't have wet water, if you don't have source capacity, you can't build your development. And the concurrency laws are being rewritten and being revised. But I think there's still an idea that there's a need for the county for us to keep an eye on that and not allow development that doesn't have wet water and does have water that's resilient and is going to be around for a long, long time. I think that's very important. It got away from us for a while. We used to think, well, the state engineer and water quality, they'll keep track of this stuff and they won't let anybody develop if they don't have water. But those people aren't policemen. They're not real-time regulators. And so the county has moved in and has been developing new versions of concurrency to fit with the new structure, but very much involved in making sure we have water for the development that we're providing. And so water is becoming a land use planning tool.
And part of what you're saying that I'm hearing is if you have entitled growth or entitled development, which
right.
we have a lot of sure. in both Summit County, Wasatch County, and a fair amount even inside the city, mm-hmm. that entitled growth and development is entitled to water. And one of the issues is that we have three different water providers. So if one provider can't bring you wet water to guarantee or can't guarantee you that wet water to allow you to develop, another one can. And that, therefore, you're not dealing with one entity, which would simplify the whole process. You're dealing with three suppliers, and you have a legal obligation to provide it to that entitled development that already exists.
Yeah, and we do have a good regionalized system that has, as you say, made the water systems redundant. And so there's an interplay between them. They help each other out. And it's set up mostly by area. If you're in a certain area, you have a certain provider, and you can either bring water to the table with your development, or you could ask the water company involved at where you can just simply buy it out. And they're starting to look at reuse plans where we can recycle some of this water and reuse some of this water and have less of a demand on some of the water developments. And I think that's there are some issues with that, but I think that's something that we do need to pursue for some of these new developments. All of these water companies have a decent amount of water, and over the past 10 years have gone out and gotten enough water so that people can subscribe with them and ask for that water. But they can also ask these new developments to work with the conservation, to work with reuse, to work with some of these new options that we might have to take the load off the rest of us.
Now, what about water treatment? We haven't even talked about that. But here in Park City, we have a huge issue with treating our water. A lot of it comes out of the Judge Tunnel, the Spiro Tunnel, and even the water that I think comes out of some of our wells is treated at the Quinns or the Spiro treatment plants.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a necessity. That's to meet EPA standards or clean water standards because we have so many heavy metals in our water.
Right, right. That has been a problem here for years. We have about 1,000 miles worth of tunnels underneath the town here that act as a nice underdrain system. And so a lot of our water is caught and comes out of these tunnels. And it's been pretty convenient for us to use it over the past few years because it comes out high and we just drop it in the system and away it goes. But the EPA has regulated that. And the city, I think, has been very proactive in what they're using and what they're not using. And a few years ago stopped using some of those mine sources because of the heavy metals, the arsenic, the antimony, those kinds of things, and have gone to other sources. The city buys a lot of water from the Lost Canyon pipeline coming up over that way to replenish some of the water that they're not taking from the mine sources.
Well, and then this big pipeline from the Judge Tunnel over to the Spiro Treatment Plant, which is about to be completed, and that will once again bring the Judge Tunnel online. Right now, that water is going down Poison Creek, which has been wonderful for the last couple of years because we've had water flowing through town.
Right, and I think the burden has been on the city because whether they use that water or not, they still have to treat it. And so they're trying to work out ways where they can use as much of this water, treat this water. It's expensive treatment for this water. But also, look into the options of trying to leave some of it in a stream because there are other values of water than just putting it in pipelines and sending it down the canyon. And so I think especially Park City, because they deal mostly with the wine, the the mine sources, they've been very proactive, and they've really stayed ahead of the EPA. Even though the EPA is making their standards more and more stringent, Park City has gotten ahead of this. And the redundancy of regionalization has helped them do it, has allowed them to do it. It gives them different choices. It gives them different options.
Laughlin Water, you work for.
Yes.
That's a local company. What do you do on a daily basis?
On a daily basis? Well, Laughlin Water was originally, they did a lot of groundwater. They would drill wells and find water for the water companies, for Park City, for Mountain Regional, for everybody in the area and around the state of Utah. And I came into it with more of a surface water. And so I've always my history has been working with dams and rivers and doing that kind of restorations, and also in the water right world, helping people deal with their water rights. And we do a lot of work for a lot of ski resorts and working with them with their snowmaking and doing snowmaking ponds and getting water rights for their consumptive use of their snowmaking systems. And so there's a lot of variety in Laughlin now, and I hope I brought a surface water component to the company. I bring a bird's eye view to their worm's eye view of water development.
I wish we had time to talk more about water rights. I bet there are a lot of people making a lot of money out there on water rights. And I just had an experience where we were looking at a piece of property in Midway, and it didn't mm-hmm. have enough water shares. And we said, well, and I'd never been exposed to this, but I said, how do you find or buy a water share? Oh, you just go on KSL.com and look for one. I thought that was the funniest thing.
It is. It's KSL.com and Craigslist. That could be your first stop shopping.
Yeah.
But there are people that buy and sell water, and there are brokers that do it. And buying with water rights can be kind of tricky to know what you're really getting. You know, what kind of consumptive use was the old water right, and how is that going to translate to my use? Am I going to get a big haircut when I go through the state engineer's office? So it's not always apples to apples and orange to orange. And so in most cases, people get at least an attorney involved, if not an engineer. And we do water rights consulting like that at Laughlin Water as well.
Okay. Matt Linden, thank you for joining us today. Before we let you go.
Yes.
Because the winter is, well, it's almost upon us.
Yes.
We'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about El Nino. I know you're not a climatologist, but...
No, but, you know, and we're...
But you did sleep at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
You know, and everybody loves to talk about the weather, and we're involved with water, so we're as much involved with the weather. And there's a lot of talk about El Nino and this massive El Nino, and that's all well and good. Even though we're a borderline state, sometimes it hits us, sometimes it doesn't. What I've been focusing on has been this persistent high pressure that's been hanging out in the Pacific for many, many years, that's has been blocking our weather, has been put us in this drought situation. I think that's still in place, and the water temperatures in the North Pacific are 4 to 5 degrees above average, and they have been for quite a while. And I think that will come to play in how winter shakes out. But I think it could be a warm and a wet winter here.
Okay. Not what we really want to hear, but...
I'm sorry. That's my call.
Okay. Matt Linden, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, Tim.
And let's thank our underwriters.
Alpine Apothecary, Grand Valley Bank, and Heber Valley Bank, the doctors at the Park City Specialty Clinic, Park Meadows Country Club, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties.
And want to make sure that you all tune in tomorrow during the 9 o'clock hour. Instead of Cool Science Radio, we'll be live broadcasting a candidate forum. It's five of the city council candidates will be here in the studio with me, and we'll be talking about some of the issues like water.
Excellent.
And we'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Josh Carr of Park Meadows Country Club, sponsor of KPCW's The Mountain Life. Park Meadows, now managed by Stein Erickson Lodge, is a private country club located in town offering a Jack Nicklaus signature course, on-mountain facilities at Deer Valley, pool and fitness center. Golf and social memberships are available at 649-2460 or parkmeadowscc.com.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank's Park City branch. We have been part of this community since 1998 as a local town bank. We take pride in giving back by supporting KPCW and many other local nonprofits. We have branches in Heber City, Midway, and Park City on Deer Valley Drive. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW is provided in part by Hideout Canyon, master planned community on the lake. Info at hideoutcanyon.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bethler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Time for news.